Who's going to drive you home today on The World? I'm Carol Hills. Some are touting self-driving cars as the future of transportation, but will they help or hurt the environment? Might depend on how you design them.
For example, we could invest in autonomous vehicles that are much lighter weight and dramatically reduce the amount of energy we use, even if we're driving very fast and very far.
Plus, a bizarre story out of Sweden, where some refugee children are becoming unconscious after their families are denied asylum.
There was media coverage saying that this was a national tragedy, that it was equivalent to forced sterilizations. It really captivated the public.
But is this so-called resignation syndrome real? Find out ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. As a candidate, Donald Trump vowed to pull the U.S. out of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Now President Trump has to decide if he's going to go through with it. At stake is whether the U.S. remains committed to lowering greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. We'll be keeping an eye on that story. But whatever Trump decides, future U.S. emissions will be impacted by a wide variety of factors, some of which are largely independent of the federal government. So we begin today with one example, self-driving cars. Backers say autonomous vehicles won't just make travel safer and less stressful, they'll also be good for the environment. We asked the world's Carolyn Beeler for a reality check on that.
Basically, to make a normal car a self-driving car, you strap some eyes to it and you give it a brain.
This is Carl Yanyama, who's standing next to a tricked-out electric car in a Boston garage. The brain of the car he's talking about is computer hardware in the trunk. And the eyes?
The eyes are these other sensors that you see mounted on different parts of the car. There's a LiDAR sensor on the roof, and there are cameras bristling all over the car, and those help detect other cars, pedestrians, other objects.
Yanyama is the CEO of Newtonomy. The company is testing this car in Boston's Seaport District. Passengers aren't allowed yet, I asked, but riders are allowed in pilot tests overseas.
We partnered with a company called Grab, which is kind of the Uber of Singapore. So a customer could hail one of our cars, and if we happened to be on the road at that time, we would pick them up and they could take a ride in a self-driving car.
One day, Yanyama wants to compete with current ride-sharing companies by offering cheaper fares. But before self-driving cars hit the roads for real, a lot of questions have to be answered. Will they be safe? Will they be reliable? And what will they mean for the environment? Some backers say they'll cut down on fuel use and pollution by driving more efficiently than people do. But Yanyama isn't quite sure if that's going to be true for his business model.
One thing that may happen is if you reduce the cost of transportation, people may take more trips because it's cheaper. But it's hard to predict.
Really hard. Ann Schlenker at the Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois is one of the people trying to make that prediction. She says a recent study found driverless cars could cut gas consumption by a huge amount, up to 90%. But that same study found fuel use could also increase by 200%.
So we are on a path to refine those numbers, as are other researchers, because it was quite a startling future.
So we're now headed over to a testing area.
In a big garage downstairs from her office, about half a dozen cars are hooked up to testing equipment. The lab is looking at automated features that already exist on some cars to see how they affect fuel consumption. She steps up in front of one of the cars.
So this actually is a Toyota Prius Prime.
The car optimizes when it shifts into electric mode to save fuel.
It has adaptive cruise control.
That automatically adjusts the car's speed.
So all of those early automation features do indeed improve the environmental signature.
Other new automated features could also increase the efficiency of each trip. But there might also be more trips because more people will be able to use driverless cars, like elderly people who can't drive anymore, and kids. Driverless cars might also change where we live.
Rather than a 30-minute commute, now you're willing to entertain a 60-minute commute to get cheaper housing because I can be productive while the car takes me into the office when I need to go.
Yet another factor? Without human error, the risk of car crashes is predicted to plummet. Now, that's a good thing for safety, of course, but it might also mean we'll drive faster and use a lot more gas.
Some of these future scenarios are very scary.
Jason Rugolo is at ARPA-E, the energy department agency that invests in advanced energy technologies. To avoid these scary future scenarios, Rugolo is looking at funding research into even more fuel-efficient self-driving car designs.
For example, we could invest in autonomous vehicles that are much lighter weight, could have much better drag coefficients, so they look much more like a fish instead of a block moving through the air. And all of these developments could dramatically reduce the amount of energy we use, even if we're driving very fast and very far.
No matter what the cars look like, there's still the question of how they'll be used. Singapore, where Nutonomy is testing its technology, is a tiny, crowded country that doesn't want more cars clogging its streets, driverless or otherwise. It hopes automated vehicles will help. Here's Lee Chon Tech with Singapore's Ministry of Transport.
Our plan is that by 2030, 8 in 10 people will be able to walk to the train station.
For the 2 in 10 who can't, Lee wants tiny self-driving cars, or pods, to fill that gap.
Self-driving pods to bring people from their doorstep to the train station, I think, will help encourage more people to take public transport.
Singapore is also funding research into self-driving buses to expand their bus networks. Now, this future full of self-driving vehicles is still years away. But if we don't start planning for it now, driverless cars could land us right where we started, stuck in traffic, surrounded by bad air. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Boston.
Here's another issue that people worry about when it comes to driverless cars: hacking. With a computer system literally running the vehicle for you, how do you make sure hackers can't take control of the car? Automotive security researcher Charlie Miller has thought a lot about that. Charlie, you've warned that designing security for driverless cars is a real challenge. How much of a challenge?
Well, it has all of the problems of regular car security, and then you add in a bunch more computers and sensors and take the human out of the front seat altogether. So it's a difficult problem, but one that we're going to need to solve if we're going to rely on these vehicles.
Have any been successfully hacked into?
No. In fact, no ordinary cars have been hacked into by a bad guy. So researchers like me and Chris Valasek have shown that you can hack into cars, but it's only been researchers who have shown this. So it's still a very cutting edge kind of research that's been done. The common criminal hasn't managed to do that, even for a common car.
So you yourself hacked into a car?
Oh, yeah. So Chris and I showed a 2014 Jeep Cherokee. We were able to hack into it from anywhere in the U.S. And we could do things like control the steering, control the brakes. It was pretty scary stuff.
Did you do those things?
Yeah, but but it was only with a test subject who had agreed to be part of the experiment. So we didn't do it to any just random car.
How did you do it?
Well, the radio, the head unit of the car, was talking to the internet to get things like traffic updates. And I got a cellular phone, and the computer in the car had the equivalent of a cellular phone connection to the internet, and I was able to connect to it. And there was a vulnerability in their code that I took advantage of, and then I was able to run code on their car. And I could then send messages to the other components, like the brakes or the steering, and tell the steering that, hey, you should turn the steering wheel right now. And then the car would answer and do that.
So you're a good guy, and you did this as a test, but are there bad guys or gals who could do this as well?
It's hard to do. It's technically hard, and I know what I'm doing. But basically, we shouldn't be in a situation where two guys in a garage can manage to hack a Jeep, which is where we are right now.
If a driverless car was hacked, what things could a hacker make the car do? I mean, what's the worst case scenario?
The worst case scenario is, again, before I even say this is my job, is to make sure this doesn't happen. But the worst case scenario is, if a bad guy's controlling the computer that's controlling the car, then the bad guy controls the car. And so they could drive you off in a ditch or, you know, accelerate you very quickly. And anything you can imagine, you know, the worst Fast and the Furious 8 kind of scenario, they can make come true. So we need to make sure that doesn't happen.
Now, you used to work for Uber, which is developing a driverless car, and you now work for a Chinese startup that's doing the same thing. That startup's called Didi. Do you find that these companies are taking this issue seriously?
I think so. I mean, they need to get people to trust the vehicles, not just that they're going to get them to the right place and safely, but that they don't have to worry about this cyber security threat as well. So it's pretty important to them for the users to trust them. And part of that is to make sure the security is done right.
And you're working on this very problem?
Absolutely. So I was one of the few people who have hacked a car. And so I think it's a perfect for me to work on a car to make it unhackable. So I know the way bad guys get in, and I can help try to figure out ways to make it to where they can't.
Is it going to require making a whole nother layer of security or some sort of technology that you don't even know what it is yet to be the firewall to make sure that driverless cars, when they're finally developed, are not hacked into?
I think we understand the problem, and we understand how to solve the problem, how to make these cars very, very secure. It's just a matter of doing the hard work of doing the engineering and the design and following through and testing and all that kind of hard work. But I think it's something it's possible to do, but it's going to take some time. And that's why we need to do it now before we have a million driverless cars driving around and then say, oh, maybe we should have thought about security. So I think it's really important to get going now on the problem so that we're ahead of the curve.
Do you really see driverless cars happening, becoming extremely common?
I think so. I think my grandkid will never drive a car. Like, I think we're going to get to a place where my grandchildren are going to be amazed that humans drove cars, because computers are just going to do such a better job at it than people.
If a driverless taxi arrived to take you to your destination, what would go through your head? Would you get in?
Absolutely, I'd get in. I'd much rather have a computer driving a car than a person, because I've seen a lot of really bad human drivers out there.
Charlie Miller is an automotive security researcher. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
It's not often we get a glimpse of what's happening inside North Korea. To hear from a top government official is even rarer. So imagine our BBC colleague John Sudworth's surprise when he managed to get into the country and secure an interview with North Korea's vice foreign minister. Here's John's story from Pyongyang.
North Korea is all about shows of strength. The first came in this taekwondo demonstration. The next in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square, close to the center of power, by way of a rare interview with the country's vice foreign minister, Han Song-ryol.
If the United States is reckless enough to use military means, it would mean from that very day an all-out war. Our nuclear weapons protect us from that threat. We will be conducting more missile tests on a weekly, monthly, and yearly basis.
If you could send one message to Donald Trump, what would it be?
I would tell him that if the United States encroaches on our sovereignty, then it will provoke an immediate counter-reaction. If the USA is planning a military attack against us, we will react with a nuclear preemptive strike by our own style and method.
Rather than developing nuclear weapons, wouldn't North Korea be better focusing on reforms here at home? For example, closing the system of political prison camps in which tens of thousands of people are known to be kept for even the most limited of opposition and dissent.
We do not tolerate any others criticizing our style of socialism, and we believe in the choice we have made. As for the so-called political prison camps, it is something that our enemies have fabricated and disseminated by their followers in order to demonize our country. We do not have the kind of shooting sprees like in other countries, armed men who start shooting people. You also live in a certain country and a certain system. If people force you to adopt another country's way of life, you will also go against that.
North Korea's vice foreign minister ending that report from Pyongyang by the BBC's John Sudworth. Just ahead, the refugee kids in Sweden who suffer from resignation syndrome. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills with the world. They're like Snow White. They just fall away from the world. That's how one doctor in Sweden describes the cases of hundreds of children there over the past several years. We're talking about a specific group of kids. They are the children of asylum seekers, mostly between 8 and 15 years old. They suddenly fall unconscious after they're told that the family's asylum application has been rejected. And here's where it gets bizarre. The kids slowly return back to normal in cases where the asylum request is approved. You might be thinking, come on, that can't be real. But Swedish doctors have even given this a name, resignation syndrome. And they started noticing a pattern long before the current European migrant crisis. Rachel Aviv has written about it for The New Yorker.
It was in the early 2000s, and there are various theories about why it emerged at that point. And I think the most dominant one was that Sweden at that time had started to limit the number of asylum seekers who could come to the country. And people who were not fleeing countries at war were generally denied asylum. And it was the families that had been denied asylum, it was those children that ended up developing these symptoms. So it began in the 2000s and sort of it really has continued for the last 16 years.
You follow the case of Gorgi. He's a Russian refugee who came to Sweden with his family. Tell us about him. What happened in his case?
One of the reasons I decided to write about him in particular was because he was just this very kind of loquacious, lovely, outgoing boy who considered himself Swedish and was very assimilated, and his teachers loved him. He'd been there for 8 years, and when he learned that his family was going to be deported, at first he went upstairs to his room and he refused to talk to his parents. At that point, it looked like he was just very angry and didn't want to participate in life. But within a few days, he had completely stopped speaking. Eventually, he stopped moving, and I think it was about a week later that he had the feeding tube inserted into his nose. And at that point, the doctor said there was no reaction when they inserted the feeding tube.
And what happened to him? How did it get resolved?
So he remained in that state. It began in December of 2015. And he sort of sunk deeper into the condition to the point where a doctor observed that he seemed to be barely alive. He had started to drool. By May 2016, his family was granted a residency permit. And the family sort of ran up to him and said, you know, we've been granted residency. We can stay. We can stay. And for a few weeks, he didn't seem to acknowledge that anything had changed. And then gradually opened his eyes. After a few more weeks, he started to speak. And by the time that I met him in November 2016, I would not have known that he'd been sick. He said that he was still sort of physically exhausted, but otherwise I'm not sure I would have been able to tell.
Now, listening to this, you think, well, how can this be an actual physical syndrome that's mm-hmm. peculiar to Sweden? I mean, how has that understanding of this come about?
Yeah, and I as I talk about this right now, I feel like it sounds surreal and not believable, and I'm aware of that and felt that a little bit as I was reading about it. But when I met the children, it's just not a syndrome that can be faked. There was something so profound about the state that they were in, and just to watch the way that they reacted to people or didn't react to people. It did seem as if they were in a deep coma. But why does it happen in Sweden? Was that the original question you'd asked?
Well, how have they determined or thought that this is something specific to Sweden? How do people know it hasn't happened in other places?
You know, I don't think that they could know. I have been thinking about this since the article came out. And one thought I had was that in Sweden, people who are seeking asylum, if they are children, they're entitled to full health care. So a child who's come there who's not documented has the right to see a child psychiatrist. I don't think that that is the case in most other countries. So there is a possibility that there are isolated cases of this behavioral pattern or illness in other places, but it's not coming to the attention of the kind of academic psychiatrists who would write about it.
How have Swedes reacted to this?
It felt very foreign to me, especially in the days following Trump's election and everything that followed, to be thinking about the Swedish reaction to these children. It's just a couple hundred children, and it completely galvanized the political conversation for years. There were debates about whether they should all be granted asylum. There were petitions. There was media coverage saying that this was a national tragedy, that it was equivalent to forced sterilizations. It really captivated the public.
But where does it stand today? Is it still a recognized syndrome that's going on and people are kind of hand-wringing about it, or is there a consensus about what it is?
There's a consensus that this is a real illness, which for a while there was some debate. particularly among sort of right-wing anti-immigration figures, they said that this couldn't be real. So now there is a consensus that it is real. But as far as what causes it, I think most people believe that it is related to that trauma of feeling like you've lost hope and you don't know how your life will continue, and that it's almost this very literal physical manifestation of the kind of psychological despair that children in this situation are experiencing.
Have there been any cases where a family has been turned down for asylum, a child in the family has been exhibiting these symptoms, and the family does not eventually get accepted? Have children come out of this syndrome without having their family's asylum cases been accepted? It sounds a weird question, but that's how
so
I have to ask.
All I know of are two cases. Most of the children with the illness were granted asylum, but I know of two cases where they weren't and the families were deported. And then psychologists, or in some cases journalists, Swedish journalists, went to the home country where the children were from and tried to see how they were faring. And in those two cases, the children had not recovered. They were still bedbound.
It's just so hard to believe. Has anyone ever died from resignation syndrome?
I don't think so. Not that I know of. There has been a case of a child who was in that state for 4 years, which is very troubling. One concern I had as I was researching this was that maybe there was such an emphasis on the way that this illness was caused by social factors that maybe more attention should have been devoted to treating the problem medically. If it is a kind of catatonia, which many people think it is, then it seemed that there was a possibility of using medication to intervene in that state. But the Swedish doctors that I talked to thought that that was unethical because they couldn't get consent from the patient. And they really believed that this was not an illness that they had the tools to treat. They felt that as doctors, they were sort of paralyzed because this was a social and a structural problem.
Has there ever been any discussion about whether Swedes have given this a name and tried to label it because it's just so un-Swedish?
That's a good point. I would say that giving this a name could, in a way, reinforce it. It becomes a concrete entity. Once it becomes a permissible way of sort of expressing despair, I think there probably is an element of psychological contagion. So in the act of naming the illness, it kind of becomes real and it becomes legitimate, and it's a way to sort of show how we are suffering.
Rachel Aviv writes for The New Yorker. She reported about the so-called resignation syndrome that's occurring to some children of migrants in Sweden. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Author Ernest Hemingway had a thing for actress Marlene Dietrich, and he loved to tell her about it in his letters.
What do you really want to do for a life work? Break everybody's heart for a dime? You could always break mine for a nickel, and I'd bring the nickel.
Steamy. The Hemingway-Dietrich connection, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Big vote coming up in France. In fact, it's being called the most unpredictable French presidential election in a generation. Polls suggest the four main candidates are all within striking distance of one another, heading into the first round of voting this Sunday. The top two move on to a second round in May. Correspondent Vivian Walt in Paris went to rallies last night for a couple of contenders, including far-right leader Marine Le Pen.
Her message last night was that she would effectively stop all immigration into France and that the whole terrorist threat was effectively rooted in immigration into France. And she repeated one mantra over and over again, which is, I will protect you.
How did the crowd respond?
Well, the crowd responded with great enthusiasm, waving a lot of flags, cheering on est chez nous, which is translatable into this is our home, and very much a kind of us against them refrain through these meetings. However, I have to say, there were a lot of empty seats last night at the rally, and the energy felt a little bit staged and a little bit stiff. She has run into some political trouble here in the last phase of the campaign.
So take us over to the other crowd you spent time in last night for centrist Emmanuel Macron. How did that go?
Firstly, it was in one of the big sports arenas in Paris, which seats about 21,000 people. There was not an empty seat in the place. Compared with Marine Le Pen, who did hers in a sort of medium-sized music hall that seats 6,000 people and where there were a lot of empty seats. And the energy at Macron was just one of kind of giddiness, of people just being thrilled by him. There was a real kind of breezy feel. Everybody had been given campaign T-shirts that were pink and yellow and sky blue, and the whole place had a bit of a carnival atmosphere.
To be fair, Marine Le Pen's support is really not in Paris, isn't it? More in rural areas and smaller cities?
Well, absolutely. We're talking Paris here. And in fact, Macron's base is very much Paris. He's very much a Parisian. You know, he's an urbane, global person who speaks perfect English.
Now, tell us about the far-left guy who's suddenly making a show, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. What's behind his new momentum?
Well, you know, he, firstly, is a very canny campaigner. And in fact, some of the folks that have designed the final phase of his campaign, really studied very closely the campaign of Bernie Sanders, and in fact went to the U.S. last year and traveled around on the Bernie Sanders campaign to see how Sanders campaigned on really no money, very much as Mélenchon is doing. He has this very populist, folksy feel to him. His message is one of huge state, public state intervention in the economy. He wants to tax the super wealthy at a 100% tax rate for income above 400,000 euros. That's about $430,000 a year. So he really is a communist. He has the support of the French Communist Party. And he has a kind of message and a style that is really caught fire among a really sizable population of French voters.
Vivian, I've read that despite all the campaign hype and uncertainty about this upcoming election, more than 30% of those eligible to vote in France say they don't intend to go to the polls. How do you explain that?
You know, there is such a, what the French call dégagisme, which is essentially throw the bums out feeling in France. People are fed up with all sides. And there is a great cynicism that they've, you know, been to the polls so many times for the presidential elections and the legislative elections and the European Parliament elections, and that nothing actually really seems to change. And I think people have really hit a kind of critical point of cynicism. This really is the major challenge for the candidates in the last 5 days of this election. They've got to get people out to the polls. And particularly, that is the task for Emmanuel Macron. The fans of Marine Le Pen will probably go through a hurricane to get to the polls for her. But the same cannot be said for Emmanuel Macron. His really major issue is to try and break the big number of abstentions.
Vivian Walt is based in Paris. She writes for Time magazine. Thanks a lot, Vivian.
You're welcome.
We're staying in France for the next few minutes to hear about a true crime story known as the Jacques Fesch affair. Jacques Fesch was the wayward son of a Paris businessman. He was convicted of murdering a policeman and executed by guillotine in 1957. Now there's a new twist to the tale as Jacques' son seeks a posthumous pardon from the French state. Emma Jacobs has the story from Paris.
Gerard Fesch didn't learn that his father was a notorious murderer until he turned 40. Gerard grew up in foster care, his records sealed. He only knew his mother's first name, Thérèse.
Every time I tried to look into my past, I would come up with possible theories for why I'd been abandoned. I suspected I might uncover something unpleasant, but I never imagined this.
That his father was Jacques Fesch, one of the last men to be executed in France.
C'est un homme qui était en mal de vivre.
He was a man who was uncomfortable in his own skin, says Gerard. By the time he was 24, Fesch had a wife and a daughter and a pregnant mistress. But he wanted to escape it all and sail to Tahiti. He asked his father for the money for a boat, but his father refused. So to finance his plan, Fesch got a gun and tried to rob a currency dealer, who was also a friend of his father's.
Enfin bref, ça se passera très mal. Le hold-up échoue, enfin complètement.
The hold-up went very, very wrong. He was chased and it ended finally with him shooting and killing a policeman.
The crime made headlines. The officer's funeral procession was on TV news. All the papers followed Fesch's trial. But what came out later was Fesch's spiritual awakening in prison. He had become a devout Catholic, so devout that his letters and journals were published after his death in 1957 and became widely read in France. He composed his most famous line the night before his execution. In 5 hours, he wrote, "I will see Jesus." Gerard hadn't heard of Jacques Fesch until a friend gave him an article about him. Gerard picked it up late one night and started reading.
C'est juste à la fin que Jacques Fesch aurait eu un enfant qui se prénomme Gérard.
Right at the end, the article mentioned that Jacques Fesch had a child named Gérard with a young woman, Thérèse. But this child has been abandoned and no one knew where he was. At that point, I started to wonder.
The next day, he called the journalist who wrote the piece. And that was the beginning of a long process. A DNA test eventually proved that he was the son of Jacques Fesch, which allowed him to legally adopt his name. Gerard also found out other things about his father's life, like that he played the trumpet, like Gerard did. He said it's all been a dizzying journey.
Enfin, c'est pas banal quand même, avec un père qui a été guillotiné.
It's not every day you find you had a father who was guillotined, and today they want to beatify him.
Jacques Fesch's spiritual awakening in prison was considered so stunning and his writings so moving that the French Catholic Church petitioned the Vatican to make him a saint. That process has been going on for decades. Since his personal discovery, Gerard has collected piles of material about his father, including letters he receives regularly now from people touched by his writings.
Il y avait ce chanteur très très connu, etc., qui est décédé il y a pas très longtemps.
There was this very well-known French singer diagnosed with cancer. Several months before he died, he sent me a note saying my father had helped him a lot and that he was truly a saint.
At the moment, Gerard is more interested in getting his father a pardon from the French state.
Demander une réhabilitation, c'est peut-être essayer de montrer Jacques Fesch.
Maybe it's to try to show Jacques Fesch was not just an assassin, the person who had killed. But that 60 years later, we're still talking about him. He's still here. He helps people, frankly, and helps people find comfort.
For Gerard Fesch, there's comfort in knowing who his parents are. He says he met his mother, Thérèse, once before her death, but it didn't go all that well. And ultimately, he said he's come to feel much closer to his father, who he never met. He said he doesn't go a day without thinking about him. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
Now to a surprising discovery in London, an ancient crypt long forgotten. It served as the resting place for some of the most influential churchmen in England. It's thought 5 of the 30 coffins in the crypt contain the remains of archbishops of Canterbury. The discovery was made some time ago, but only made public 2 days ago on Easter Sunday. Harry Mount, a reporter with the Daily Telegraph, was the first outsider to see inside the lost tomb. Harry, what did you see?
Well, it was incredibly exciting. There's a tiny little hole leading down to a crypt beneath the altar in St. Mary's Church, a small parish church next to Lambeth Palace, where the Archbishops of Canterbury, who are the head of the Church of England here, live. And there were 30 lead coffins tumbled all over on top of each other. And on top of one of them, there was an archbishop's mitre or crown, gleaming golden red in the light of my torch. It was incredibly exciting.
Wow. So you're using a flashlight to look in, and the mitre looked like it was in pretty good shape. I would imagine all dusty and kind of a mess.
No, it's an incredible shape. It's just rested there. It's since been discovered that it's a 17th century mitre belonging to a 17th century Archbishop of Canterbury, who would have been the head of the church in the days when America was part of Britain. And it's incredibly good shape. It's half red, half gold. And the story behind it is extraordinary, that some builders were converting the altar and they're doing a big refurbishment and they were removing the altar stone there. And accidentally, they tore a 6-inch diameter hole in the altar and suddenly saw these steps leading down to this vault. And no one knew that these five archbishops, who the Archbishop of Canterbury is the number one man in the Church of England. No one knew they were there. So it's a really staggering find.
So how did you end up being in the right place at the right time?
Like everything, through friendship and nepotism. The man who runs the museum, Christopher Woodward, who's in charge of the Garden Museum, is a friend of mine. He said to me a couple of weeks ago he'd made this discovery, or these builders had made this discovery. They went running to him as the director of the museum when they discovered it. And he said he thought it might make a good story, and I thought it'd make a particularly good story for Easter, as opposed to having, you know, the empty tomb of Christ. Here was a tomb crammed with people.
What's the significance of this find, of these particular archbishops?
Well, there's one in particular, Archbishop Bancroft, who was archbishop from 1604 to 1610, who was in charge of the King James Bible, which was the translation of the Bible commissioned by King James I. And Archbishop Bancroft was the churchman in charge of this translation, which produced what I think is the greatest, most beautiful translation of the Bible, which is often used in English churches, and I believe American churches too.
I understand that particular translation of the Bible was as influential on the English language as Shakespeare.
I would say it was, and actually people use expressions from it the whole time without knowing that they're quoting from the Bible. It has a wonderfully beautiful, harmonious, natural sound to it. Words like the quick and the dead, it has fed its way into the English language. So actually it's English at just the same time as Shakespeare, in the same way that Shakespeare's had a great influence on the current English language in Britain and America, so has the King James Bible.
Now, to get a little ghoulish, has anyone peeked inside the coffins?
They haven't. I was longing to have a look myself, but they're a bit, I think, overcautious. They're worried because this vault has been hidden for at least 150 years, probably longer. They're worried that if you walk inside, perhaps the vault itself will collapse. And the other thing is that if you have a coffin that's undisturbed for 400 or so years, most of us turn into dry human remains, but some of us turn into so-called coffin liquor. So if I'd gone straight in there and wrapped on the coffins, I might have been covered with liquefied archbishop. So I wasn't allowed to go inside.
Now, what's going to happen to these remains and the tomb now that they've discovered it?
Well, what they're going to do, I think, in a quite good, reverent way, although I'd have preferred to have brought out the archbishop's mitre and the coffins, but what they're going to do is they're going to leave them down there out of respect, which I understand. And the hole that I look down through, they're going to put a glazed panel there. So you'll be able to see through the glazed panel, hopefully get a view of the coffins and that amazing mitre. If I had my way, you'd let people go down there, but I understand why they don't.
Harry Mount of Britain's Daily Telegraph, thanks for bringing this story to life.
Thank you.
Before we launch into our next story, listen to this.
You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me, come rain or come shine.
That sultry voice belongs to the late Marlene Dietrich, German movie star and femme fatale of the 1930s and 40s. She's back in the news because a love letter addressed to her is going to be auctioned off next month. And this letter is from none other than Ernest Hemingway, or Papa, as Dietrich called him. The actress and the author wrote each other for almost 30 years, until Hemingway's death in 1961. Sandra Spanier is the editor of The Complete Letters of Ernest Hemingway. She joins me now over the phone. Sandra, I had no idea that Dietrich and Hemingway were so close. So how did they meet?
They met in 1934 on a French passenger liner on a transatlantic crossing. He and his wife, Pauline, were returning from an African safari, and Marlene Dietrich told a story later that the way they actually met was that she had come into the dining room and asked to join a group of people. And when they stood up, she realized there were 12 people at the table and she would make 13. And so she started to excuse herself. And then Ernest Hemingway appeared and said he didn't mean to intrude, but he'd be glad to be the 14th person at the table.
And he probably sidled up by her and sat right next to her.
Probably. They took a long walk on the deck and talked about the poetry of her 8-year-old daughter.
So they continued to keep in touch. The letters they're pretty intense, and they clearly had a huge affection for one another. Did they actually ever have a relationship?
Well, they had a very intense platonic love relationship, I would say. They claimed that the timing was never right, that for the two of them to get together, but they were very intimate friends and talked about their families, their work. They had a scheme, sort of a fantasy scheme, that they would open a nightclub together someday. She would be the singer and he would be the bouncer. So they had a sort of playful and affectionate relationship.
Let's talk about this letter that's going up for auction. It's dated August 12th, 1952. Can you read a couple of excerpts from it?
Sure. He writes, "I always love you and admire you, and I have all sorts of mixed up feelings about you. Please know I love you always, and I forget you sometimes as I forget my heart beats, but it beats always."
Wow. Do you have any other favorite letters or favorite lines from letters you've read from Hemingway to Marlene Dietrich, or the other way around?
There are some wonderful letters. He definitely is extremely affectionate to her all along. He calls her daughter, calls her Kraut, as you mentioned. In June of 1950, he wrote to her, "Dear daughter, thank you for the lovely long letter on the long picture. You're getting so beautiful, they will have to make passport pictures of you 9 feet tall. What do you really want to do for a life work? Break everybody's heart for a dime? You could always break mine for a nickel, and I'd bring the nickel."
So I'm kind of curious why he, I mean, I sort of get why he calls her little Kraut or dearest Kraut, but the daughter thing, what's that about?
He did tend to use that term for younger women, not the ones he was married to, but ones he felt affection for. So that is not a unique name for Marlene Dietrich.
What do you think the letters reveal about their relationship and about their personalities?
They seem to have a sense of a real camaraderie, both having been present at the Second World War. They actually also got together a number of times at the Ritz Hotel after Hemingway had sort of, as they say, liberated the Ritz Hotel with the Allied troops.
Where was the Ritz Hotel?
In Paris. Mm-hmm. In Paris. And Marlene Dietrich also kept a room there as a base because she was going around and entertaining the troops. So there were a number of encounters at the Ritz Hotel. He wrote a long poem about death, having attached himself to a particular infantry unit where 67 men had died in a 24-hour period. He was heartbroken and wrote a long poem about that. And he asked Marlene Dietrich to read this poem in the Ritz bar, and reportedly everyone had tears in their eyes, including her. They both felt the war very intensely. And after the war, they had this feeling that they had been through something together and they were both tough people. There's a letter from June of 1950 where he tells her, "We indestructibles should keep good contact. I'm an old indestructible and you are a young one, but we are different from the others." And he goes on to say, "Toi et moi, you and me, have lived through about as bad time as there ever were. I don't mean just wars. Wars are spinach. Life in general is the tough part. In war, all you have to do is not worry and know how to read a map and give coordinates." And he also goes on to say, "I would love to write something about you because you are one of my few heroes."
What do you think Hemingway and Dietrich saw in each other?
I think they were both strong personalities. They both had to contend with their own celebrity and carve out a private space. And I think they saw that in each other and respected that in each other and felt close because of that common experience, which not everyone has.
Hemingway is known for his spare narrative style. Do these letters sound like his books?
First of all, his style ranges all over the place. He's known for spare narrative style, but there are also works that he wrote where there are sentences that are almost a paragraph long. But in his letters, he tends to be much chattier. they're not disciplined at all. And in his published work, he would polish and revise endlessly. He rewrote the ending of his novel, A Farewell to Arms, 47 different times. In the letters, he would just dash off his thoughts spontaneously. So you do get that sense of immediacy in his letters, the chattiness, the slang, humor, certainly, and then this intensity of feeling. In his published work, there's sort of this understatement, this grace under pressure, the tight-lipped feeling, and that's not at all the way his letters read.
Sandra Spanier is the editor of The Complete Letters of Ernest Hemingway. Sandra, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
That letter from Hemingway to Marlene Dietrich will be up for grabs next month at an auction in New York. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
Vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor, steht eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. Dort wollen wir uns wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen wie einst.
PRI, Public Radio International.